This is a Hot Pie original.
Welcome to the Amy Edwards Show. I'm your host, Amy Edwards. We have a fantastic guest today, Eric Godsey. You know, he's a coach and I've known him a little bit, and we finally really got to sit down today, and he has so much to share that speaks to all these parts of us. And really, it confirms things that you know deep down in your soul, which I way dig that. So without being intimidating. So that's even better. I'm very excited to share that conversation with you today. Thank you so much for being here. A little bit of business. Sign up for the newsletter if you haven't yet. I'm rolling on those every week, and they are a lot of fun for me to write and just take what I'm doing in these and just push it a little bit further. So you can sign up for those at amyedwards.com. Also, if you can subscribe, rate, review, share with a friend, those all super matter in the podcast world. And just up top, I want to just ask for it and know that I am so grateful if you can find a few seconds to do that. I also just want to share, you know, that one of the things we do here is go easy on ourselves and just try to build, baby step it into some practices that are going to make us our most rocking versions, which is what I've been doing over the last, I don't know how many years, and just keep moving forward and keep trying to get better and better at transforming our lives into our most badass rocking selves. So thank you for being here, for showing up for yourselves, and let's get to it. Good Life produces a line of ultra premium basics to ensure you always look your best while being at your most comfortable. Good Life was developed by a team of fashion industry veterans who aim to provide the best fitting essentials from the finest of materials made right here in the USA. Good Life just opened a new store in the Domain Northside. So stop by the new Austin location and get 20% off when you mention code AMY20. Code is also valid on your entire order at goodlifeclothing.com. Again, the code is AMY20 for 20% off at Good Life Clothing. Okay, here we are. Yay! Here we are, another week. And I have had a couple things on my mind. One of them is an experiment, and I want to share it at the end. So please stay till the end after the conversation, because it's like a word idea. And I'm trying it in my own life, and I want to explain it to you and see, just, I don't know, just give it a shot and see what comes up. So that's at the end. Our guest today is Eric Godsey, and he's phenomenal. He's got a mind that is just, it blows me away. People that are so smart and can remember so much, I'm always like, God, why can't I get my brain to do that? And he's just one of those that has just a memory for things and is so articulate in how he shares. So I'm super stoked about that. And what I was already planning to talk about today really flowed with my conversation with Eric today. And what came up for me, I got this really cool deck just at this random garage sale that goes on here in Austin, and they have all these different decks. And this one called to me. It's a 52 card deck, Oracle deck, and it's called Divine Abundance. And if you're watching on YouTube, check it out. You can see it. I'm holding the box up. It's by Tosha Silver, T-O-S-H-A, Silver. And one of the things I like about it is that all the cards are like positive. You know how when you draw a card a day and sometimes you get like a card that isn't so great. Although I did draw a loss one day, but anyway, mostly it's giving you the good stuff, which I kind of prefer. Not that I don't like the other ones. I get it, but you know, sometimes you need a break. So honor that when you do. So the one that my house guest this weekend drew, and it made me think a lot, and then I drew it, is Outrageous Openness. And I just love that phrase, outrageous openness. And it made me think about how I'm bringing that to my own life and the concept of it. And on here it says, dear love with a capital L, open me to your will, release me from my attachments, surprise and delight me with your plan. You know what's needed, and I am open to receive. So there's two ways of thinking about it. One is that way that they're talking about right there. Like, you can't receive unless you're open, right? And there's, you know, this open-heartedness idea, this getting rid of the stuff that maybe we need to shed in order to be open, to be filled up, to, or to just receive in a really open and amazing way, which is a lot of what we've talked about on the show, a lot of surrender, a lot of letting go of things in order to foster that openness. So that's one way that we can take openness into our lives. And how do you get outrageous about that? I guess you just get as fucking open as you can. Like, how much can you let go? How many old stories can you let go? How much space can you clear if you want to get outrageously open? Outrage, outrageously. The word outrageous, like, is so interesting to me too, because an outrage, you know, is like big, right? And it's not necessarily happy. An outrage doesn't convey happiness, actually. It's just big, bigness, outrageous. Or maybe the word itself maybe says that this openness could trigger other people to be possibly outraged by how open we are. And that leads me to kind of the other meaning of this. So my house guest, he drew this card, and to him, it meant that he has opened so much up in his own life to his family about what he really wants to do with his life, how he really wants to live his life, who he truly is. And there's an outrageousness to that. In a family context, oh, hell yeah. You know, like that can outrage people because there's a lot of judgments, especially in a family. If you're going to be just fully open and really yourself, and I think about people who are coming out, probably, you know, that it used to be a very outrageous act in many ways, especially with a family, because it rocks the boat, right? It's like when you're that open, even though you don't want to rock the boat, even though that's not what it's meant to do because you're just honoring yourself, it's an outrageous act because it stirs up what everybody else is thinking of you and how they have your identity pegged in their mind. Not that that's right. It's just the thing that they do. So there's an outrageous openness of that. And it just creates this freeness. And he felt great. And he loved that he drew this card because of the outrageousness, openness he had been bringing to his own life. So the reason I'm telling you this too is like, how can maybe you hold on to these words and see what outrageous openness brings? Because it can stir things up, but at the same time, it can truly push you into another level of liberation and freeness, which is incredible. So it happened to me. The reason that it was speaking to me so much was because it happened to me, which Eric and I are going to get further into a little bit during our conversation. And I tell him about some things that were going on with me in the last couple weeks. And I had just a really roller coaster ride of emotions. And I was forced to get outrageously open, and just meaning outrageously open in my own perception, because I stated my own boundaries in a way I had never before. I really tapped into what I was really living and that I wasn't being true to myself. And I got open about it, which is scary, you know, especially when you're talking to your partner and you have to just open up and really let go and trust that you're going to be heard and trust that you can say it in the right way, because you might be judged, you might not be heard, you know. But if you are really coming from your heart with that openness and not thrusting anger upon someone, but rather saying, I feel X right now, maybe you can give me a little compassion and come at me with some compassion, you know, or grace, or offer me that, you know. Maybe there's ways to just really do that openness thing. And a couple other ones. One that I go into with Eric today about my kids. And that's a little bit of an outrageous openness, because I know that in parenting, there's a lot of resistance to being really super open about how you truly are, you know, around your children and like about your past. And that's outrageous. I mean, my kids have asked me things like just point blank, have you had an abortion? And the answer is yes. And I had to like figure out how to really be open and allow that. Right. And so I did. I mean, they've asked me about drugs. They've asked me about sex. And I don't have the greatest past, y'all. I mean, like, or woof, I slipped a judgment in there, didn't I? I have a past that's my past. That's things I've done. I've drank too much. I drank to an extent of what I needed to learn. If we're not going to make judgments about it. And, you know, had sex. I mean, I did all sorts of things. And how do you get outrageously open about that? And I'm not saying you tell them everything, but I am saying that you model the openness that you want to see from them or that you would like from other people. That's really hard to do because you kind of want to close or you kind of want to set an example. But what example are you really setting if you're not fully open and honest or, you know, just unwilling to even be open in a way that is truthful, right? I mean, and it's really hard, especially in a parenting context. And then, you know, there's outrageous openness with this podcast, which I just really, 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 really like what I just said, you know, and talking about, you know, abortion and sex and drugs, like talking about and my feelings, you know, about boundaries and everything like that. Like with Eric today, I talk about how much I cried over the last 2 weeks and just had a sadness that, you know, I had to deal with about some things. And, you know, am I bringing outrageous openness, which is a true vulnerability and sharing and perhaps intimacy too, which Eric and I discussed today. Like that's all pretty outrageous because it's like, what? You know, are you really like, you're really going to share that? Yeah, I am. Because I believe in it, because I believe that these conversations make things more open and beautiful and connect us all more in our own humanity. And that has that flow on, that reverberates, that matters. Yes, the word outrageous. So how can you get outrageously open? And that is a beautiful thing. And speaking of someone who's outrageously open, we have Eric Godsey on the podcast today. And I'm thrilled to have him on and all his wisdom. He is a coach in Fit for Service. And also, I think he's a coach on his own. He's really a philosopher. He's a writer. He specializes in stories. Writing the stories that we tell ourselves, the stories that society tells, the ancient stories that have shaped us. And it is so incredible to hear what he has to say about our own stories and how we can navigate them. And I'm just so excited to share them. If you want to follow him, I highly recommend it. He is on Instagram at Eric Godsey, ERICKGODSEY. On Instagram. That's also his website. So his .com. And then he collaborated with my guest from last week, Sky King, and they created the Dharma Journal, which we're going to talk about toward the end of the conversation, which actually I am going to do. And then I asked Eric to come back and we're going to delve further into the Dharma Journal. So it'd be really cool if you could check that out too. It's on Notion and it's at thedharmajournal.com. And then we could all do it together, which would be really cool. You can also check out Eric's amazing podcast called The Myths That Make Us. So I'm very excited to welcome Eric today. And I just want to say thank you for being here because every time you listen to this too, like we're doing this work together and getting more outrageously open and pushing the limits of finding the edges of our relationships with others and our connections to humanity and our connections to ourselves. And we're going further and getting outside that comfort zone. And that is where the fucking magic happens. So Let's get to today's interview with Eric Godsey.
Shall we intend?
Let's set some intentions.
Let's do it.
Oh, do you set intention every day, Eric?
No. I set intentions if I wake up and I feel like I'm kind of discombobulated, but I do pray every morning.
Yeah.
And it's not like linguistic per se most mornings.
Like
it's,
feel pray?
It's just like a felt sense of like.
I like that.
I have an altar in front of my bed and then there's a tapestry that's pretty wide that has like this tree that has eyes. Mm-hmm. And kind of the way that I pray is I kind of like, I see you. I know you see me. And I'm going to show up today. You know, like that's.
I love that.
Vibe.
I've been kind of trying to do that in my meditation, like tap into more of like less words and more feeling. Cause I tend to attach so many words to things all the time rather than just like sitting in gratitude, you know, and just summoning that feeling.
Right.
Instead of attaching all these words, I'm into words and I know how much power they have.
Me too.
Yeah. You too. But at the same time, they're really like these other medicines and stuff. It's like a vehicle maybe to get us to the feeling if we can just live that feeling.
Absolutely.
Would you? Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. There's this idea that the way it's articulated now is the map is not the territory. And what that means is that the words that you use to describe a thing are never the thing. So like a map can show you what a forest looks like, but a map cannot show you what it smells like to be in front of the tree. It can't teach you what it feels like to touch the bark, but maps are useful, you know? And
I'm kind of a map nerd actually myself.
Me too.
You are?
Well, by map nerd, I mean really into words.
I mean actual maps. No, I'm really into words too. And it's actually kind of something I'm exploring on my intro today. And but I appreciate what you're saying very much because it really is about that actual experience to get us there. And how can I feel that more and actually just embody it?
Yeah.
Rather than just say the words.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not that big of a fan of like fake it till you make it, but sometimes those words push us into feeling that, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I think like it's a function of being in the type of culture that we are in, but our culture is highly linguistic, you know, like we're super in our head. And most people who grow up in our culture are so far away from the felt sense of being in a body that almost the only, medium that they have to even connect to their experiences through the words that they use. What's really interesting is that there's a whole field of psychology that focuses on just helping people change the words, like the word games that they play with themselves. And it's called cognitive behavioral therapy.
I've heard of it.
And what's wild is it's super effective, quote unquote, compared to most of the type of healing modalities that we do in the West. And yet, once you start to understand like how trauma affects the body, CBT is actually incredibly ineffective if the body is traumatized. And I've never tried to articulate this until now, but the fact that CBT has been so effective is actually evidence of how disassociated we are as a culture from our body, that changing the words is even helpful. Like, and that's kind of hard to parse, but,
okay, take it further.
I just thought it was okay. So language in evolutionary time, language has only come on the scene in like the last blink of an eye. And it's the newest part of our brain. And it's quote unquote, the youngest part of our brain. And our culture, is obsessed with symbols and words. Because on some level we are disassociated from our animal nature, you know, our animal nature knows how to be in nature and almost no one we know knows how to be in nature.
Yeah. And I feel like a fear around it kind of, you know, like I can, it can come up real easily for me.
And like for most of my professional life, I have a degree in psychology and I thought for almost a decade that the way to heal people is to help them change their stories. And that's because I was all in the words, all in the mind. And it wasn't until I started doing research on trauma where I realized if the animal body is traumatized, the changing the words that you use can help a little bit, but they don't get to the core. And almost all of us are traumatized. You know, one of the really heavy things to feel into once you start doing research into trauma is there's what's called PTSD or acute trauma or shock trauma. And that's the type of trauma where, like, if a bomb goes off next to you and you completely shut down, that does a specific thing to the nervous system. But then there's this thing that has only recently been given a name by professionals. And it's called complex PTSD or complex trauma. And complex trauma is essentially, we are wired to seek security from our caretakers. If our caretakers are the source of trauma, it creates this deep confusion in our attachment systems, where we are trying to essentially cope with the fact that the thing that we are meant to feel safe from traumatizes us. And I talked to a somatic psychotherapist on my podcast recently, and he was essentially saying, every time your animal body has the authentic call to express in any way, whether that's screaming, crying, playing, running, exploring something, and your caretakers said or did something to inhibit that expression, you take on like a micro trauma. And trauma might be too strong of a word, but you take on this teaching how you feel is not okay. Mm-hmm. And it starts this slow, gradual accumulating disassociation from what trauma therapists call your felt sense.
Well, you lose trust in yourself too, in a fundamental way.
Right. And that helping people change the words they use only gets so deep. And what I have found, even in my personal life, is through studying trauma and learning what trauma looks like. Fundamentally, if you are getting to a place where you are starting to feel like your body feels like it's dying, and you start to like have seizures or convulsions, they're not technically seizures, but to other people, they can look like seizures. That's actually your body beginning to try to process the stored trauma. And most of us are so terrified of feeling the things that we don't want to feel that we inhibit the body's natural ability to process trauma. But once you learn about trauma, and you start to teach yourself that it's okay to feel those things, I've started to have more and more of those type of trauma releases. And to paint a picture for people, there's some really great videos online where you can go look at a prey animal that gets caught by a predator. And the classic example is when a gazelle gets caught by, you know, like a cheetah or a lion. We've all evolved to either fight or run in the presence of what feels like a predator. If neither of those options are possible, we have a third response, and it's called the freeze response. And the reason we evolved to have that is because on an animal level, if you freeze, you appear like you're dead to the predator. And unless the predator is acutely hungry, they're less likely to eat what they perceive as dead. Also, what it does is it can make the predator think that it's won. And so it might like start to look for its brothers and sisters to come eat. And then that gives the prey animal a chance to run away. The most important thing it does is it creates a physiological trigger where you are disassociated from the physical pain that's happening. And that's incredibly adaptive. What will happen if a gazelle survives is once they're safe, and we have videos of this, they'll start to have a seizure, or what will look like a seizure. But is their physiology processing that incredibly strong instinctive power that immobilizes them?
I feel like I've seen people do that.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's wild is because we have the ability to judge ourselves, and we have the ability to feel shame and guilt, we have the ability to repress. And if someone has gone through an experience that triggered a freeze response, if they haven't allowed themselves, if they haven't gotten to a place where they feel safe after the fact, and they haven't discharged that seizing energy, we now have what we call PTSD. And the symptomology of trauma, it's one of those really tough things, because once you start to read it, you're like, oh, I have most of these. Almost everyone like I know what? Has most of these. So the four classic ones, and what's really interesting is there's four adaptive reactions that come with that freeze response that if the cycle is never completed, and the completing of the freeze response cycle is the discharging of the energy through shaking. Mm-hmm. And that if you never have that completion, some part of your animal body still believes it's in the presence of the predator. So your baseline becomes a fear.
On guard.
Right.
Right.
And so I'll share the four symptoms quick, but if you don't complete it, the four symptoms start to erode your physiological health, and then they start to grow in the symptomology. And so if it's gone on for 10 years, you can have a whole list of symptoms that our culture will try to give you pharmaceuticals for, like four or five of the different symptoms. So you're on four or five different medications, but the root is that the trauma response hasn't been completed, and that if you got to the root, you wouldn't have any of the symptoms. So the four classic ones, the first one is hypervigilance. And hypervigilance is essentially like the people with the wide eyes who are always
paying attention. And
right.
Yeah.
Because their nervous system thinks there's a predator in the environment. The next one is basically hyperarousal, which is essentially like you're not in the rest or digest type of parasympathetic response. You're basically ready to sprint or to run or to do whatever. And so these are people that like will have hard time sleeping at night because they're in the hyperarousal state. Hmm. The third one is disassociation. And this is the big one. If it's easy for you to shut down in the presence of anything that's overwhelming, that's essentially disassociation. And then the last one is helplessness. That there's this feeling of like, there is nothing that I can do to improve my situation. And if that continues for about 6 months, more symptoms start to arise. And so like, if you have a hard time focusing, if you have this kind of vague sense that doom is coming, if you have a hard time sleeping, if it's hard for you to be vulnerable in relationships, if you find that you are constantly in a cycle of toxic relationships. And I have a post that people can go read where I pulled directly from the books, and it's called What is Trauma? But the symptoms can get worse and worse and worse the longer that it goes without you completing the cycle.
And you have I'll just interject too. You have a whole podcast where you read your study.
Right.
Yeah, too. People can look that up on The Myths That Make Us.
And the most interesting symptom is what they call reenactment. Mm-hmm. And reenactment is essentially, on an unconscious level, you will put yourself in similar situations that actually put you through re-experiencing the trauma. And before you understand what trauma is trying to do, that can seem like a demonic thing. Like, why the fuck would that be happening? But what's interesting is there is a force inside of you that, if it's in the right context, knows how to heal. And we have evidence of this when we look at the gazelle in nature. There is a part of you that knows exactly what to do if it's given the right context. And it knows that in order for you to heal the trauma cycle, you have to go back to the place where you froze. And then you have to not relive, but retouch that feeling so that you can then complete the response, which would essentially be like the seizing.
And you can do that through visualization, right? I mean, don't a lot of people, or is that possible?
I do think it's possible. I think the thing that it tends to be that you need either psychological technologies or external technologies to get the nervous system to a place where it feels safe enough to go back into that place. And if you're in the presence of a really experienced healer or facilitator, they can do it with just their voice. They could do it with rhythmic chanting. Holotropic breath work is a super powerful way to do this.
I'm aware of holotropic breath work. It's really powerful.
But so the core of reenactment is that it's essentially, it's actually trying to heal you.
Yeah.
It's trying to bring you back to that moment that you froze so that you can then either do the adaptive action. And I can give an example of this that would have been healing in the first traumatic experience, or it allows you to get back into that overwhelming feeling so you can process it through your body. And so I'll give two examples. Just as a side note, what we have found, and there's a great video online of biologists tranquilizing a polar bear so they could tag it. And if you watch in slow motion what the polar bear does when it's coming out of being tranquilized, because the tranquilization forces the freeze response, is once it starts to come back into its body, the micro seizing movements are actually the micro expression of what the adaptive action would have been in the presence of the predator. So the bear was running away from the helicopter. Once it was tranquilized, it was stopped in its running motion. Once it comes back online, the way its legs twitch is like it's running. Like it's actually playing out what the adaptive action would have been. So when it comes to trauma, the two examples is, so the first one would be if you simply just need a place to feel safe to move the energy. And holotropic breath work is a powerful, super powerful technique to do this. And once you hyperoxygenate long enough, you essentially go into what's called like a transpersonal state of consciousness. And you might just start weeping. You know, like if the primary trauma was when you were 8, your dad was drunk and he beat you with a shovel. And, you know, this part might have trigger warnings for sure. That if you just shut down, once you have the holotropic breath work, what might come out is like screaming, and like your arms might do this, like where they're over your head, like they're protecting your head, because that was the movement that would have been adaptive in that moment. What else can happen, which is super interesting, and it's because the language of the body is symbol, metaphor, and image. And there's technical reasons why that
symbol,
is.
Symbol, metaphor, image is the language of the body. Okay.
It's the language of the unconscious. And that's a whole rabbit hole that we can get into.
Okay. But
Peter Levine, who is the researcher that kind of discovered that this is how you can heal trauma, what he did with this woman is, this woman essentially had like severe anxiety to the point where she couldn't function. And he brought her into his office and he slowly put her through some relaxation techniques and essentially got her back to the point where she was feeling absolute terror and her heart rate dropped really low. And he got worried. And he had the intuition because of the research he was doing on animals, where in the moment he screamed, "There's a tiger behind you, start running." And she's kind of in a semi-hypnotic state in a chair. And her eyes bulge and she starts screaming and she starts to pound her feet up and down. And he puts her through a guided meditation where it was like, "There's a tree, run up that tree." And she's still in the chair, but she's screaming and her legs are trembling. And she gets to the point where she gets up the tree and he's like, "You escaped. Good job. Good job." And what he found out after that session is that when she was like 4 or 5, she had to get a tonsillectomy. And she was terrified when she was going into the surgery. And then they gave her the laughing gas or whatever. And that immobilized her. So she got immobilized as she was trying to run, or when the adaptive action would have been running. Mm-hmm. And what allowed her to process the trauma was actually going through the image of running from a tiger and going up a tree. And so I give those two examples because there's multiple ways to heal this type of thing. You know, one would be the holotropic breath work, where you don't have to relive anything specifically, but you will your body will unconsciously move in what would have been adaptive to the specific thing that happened to you. Then there's the example of this woman, where if you're in the presence of a adequate guide, they can actually put you through a metaphoric or symbolic action pattern that wasn't directly healing to whatever the original trauma was, but it gives you this felt sense that you have the ability to essentially save yourself.
Wouldn't that be the kind of thing you could use if they are micro traumas? Because like, I just have gone through some things in the last however long, and I can't identify what the trauma is.
Right. And so this is actually a great point. One of the things that Peter Levine emphasizes is you don't have to know what the actual trauma was.
That's kind of a relief.
It's such a relief. And so I think it's worth repeating.
Okay, good.
You don't have to go into your past and recover the actual memory of what the trauma is. And what's super interesting, this is a whole different line of research, but often, not often, but sometimes people will think that they're recovering a repressed memory. And the repressed memory actually, if you go back and find the people who were present, didn't not happen. But that's not what matters, is that what is the...
So the repressed memory did not occur.
And this can happen, right. But what matters is the repressed, or that memory is coming up as a symbolic image to convey an intensity of emotion.
It's the symbol.
Right.
Okay.
And that it doesn't, like one of the things that he hyper focuses on is so many people get caught up in the images that arise once you start to go through the healing process, and they think that it's real. And that can get into that can get people into a lot of trouble. And there's this famous story that people who get degrees in psychology are often taught, where there was this woman who was working with a psychotherapist somewhere in the Northwest, and they started to the therapist believed that they were recovering repressed memories, and what the repressed memories of the girl was. That her father, who was the police chief, was actually running a satanic cult in their town.
Holy shit.
And that he raped her, and that the other police officers were all a part of this thing, and that they had raped her too, and that it had been going on for years and years.
Oh, and my God.
This is such an unsettling story, because it got to the point where the father was being interrogated so severely, and his daughter was operating as if this was a true...
Yeah, she 100% believed it, right?
And that he essentially got to the point where he admitted that he did it.
Oh, my God.
And he went to jail. And they eventually found out that there was absolutely zero evidence of this. And there was evidence to the contrary of it not being true. But the core there is she for sure experienced trauma. Mm-hmm. And that in the process of working with a psychotherapist who didn't adequately understand how trauma operated at that time, a whole story emerged, and they started to focus on the literalization of the metaphorical as opposed to working archetypically with the metaphorical. And that what would have brought healing would have been to have archetypically worked with the metaphorical. And just to give an example of this, this might trigger people, but there's a whole realm of religious people that are trying to literally prove that the Bible is essentially like a scientific and historic right. document. Science did not exist when those stories were created. And that if you look at them as parable that is transmitting metaphorical wisdom, I think that you actually get much more out of the wisdom of that book. And if you actually think about it for a moment, modern people who try to use the scientific method to prove their religious doctrines, they've actually already lost the game, because the original game wasn't a game of science. Mm-hmm. The original game was a game of wisdom. And that it's not essentially the same thing.
And stories that are passed down
right.
through many different cultures.
Right. And so
same
people are
flood,
trying,
you know,
exactly.
story or whatever it is.
They're trying to literalize a metaphor. Because like the metaphor of the flood is that at some point, something in life is going to come and disrupt you. And what a hero does in that story is they prepare for the worst possible thing. Mm-hmm. And they do it in a way where if the worst possible thing came, life could still continue afterwards. And so the metaphor of that story is live your life in such a way that if the worst possible thing happened, you and your family could still survive in a way that could bring life to the world.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, and they even add in like, and this is our lineage and we come from people who did this, right, you know, and right, so you've got it in you already or whatever it is. Right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But if you approach it literally, you're trying to prove that a flood happened at that time and that a man made a boat large enough to have every possible animal in it and that the animals didn't attack each other and that from that all the animals came and all the humans came from just those people. And then you don't even extract the wisdom, because then the wisdom would be, unless God tells me or I know a flood is coming, I'm not going to build a boat. And if something bad is coming, I will build a boat. And it's like, you actually might be missing a huge part of the teaching of that. And so to bring that back to the trauma thing, a lot of people, when they get to a place where they feel safe enough to re-enter the terror that was present in the moment of the traumatic experience when they were like 3 or 4 or 5, your unconscious, which is the body, like the intelligence of the body, might give you an image that, you know, like the worst possible thing that we can imagine is like one of our parents like did something sacrilegious to us.
Yes.
And that an image might come up where that's trying to be conveyed to you archetypically, that when you were 3, the way you experienced, you know, mom not coming to you when you were crying in the crib and you felt abandoned by the thing that created you. Instead, you might have a memory of like your mom sold you
memory,
right, quote unquote, that your mom like sold you into slavery or like sold you into a thing or like took you out somewhere and purposefully abandoned you. And that what Peter Levine stresses is that it's not the specific content of the thing that came up. It's how does that make your nervous system feel? And then can you in that moment, what he calls cultivate the felt sense, which is to simply feel it and not to judge it. And what's super interesting, and he developed this thing called somatic experiencing that's all about cultivating the felt sense. And it's that if you can non-judgmentally be aware of the extreme raw sensations that are arising in your body, they will actually on their own transform. So like if you start to feel this overwhelming sense of terror all around you, if you can step into the felt sense, you can articulate, it feels like the air around me is heavy. Mm-hmm. It feels like something's pressing on my chest and I can feel a part of me wants to scream and run. If you can hold that, it then moves into something else and then might feel like I have this pit in my stomach and I can feel that I want to start crying and I can feel that there's energy coming up into my throat. And then what a somatic experiencer will do is they'll actually get you to do specific movements to help the energy move further. And so the classic example is if you feel the energy starting to come up through your throat, what all of us do, like one of the most common ways that we repress our emotions is we clench our jaw muscle.
Oh my God, I'm such a clencher.
Me too.
That way, night guard and everything.
And so what they'll do is they'll say like, stay with that feeling, but mm-hmm. also start to slowly open and close your jaw and say, ah. So they'll be like, ah.
Ooh.
And if you have someone start to do that, it makes you unclench your jaw.
Yeah.
And if a somatic experiencer is able to do that at the right moment, 9 out of 10 times, you will start weeping and weeping and weeping. And it's as you're weeping, you might start to see images. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Peter Levine, again, highly recommends is don't attach to the content of the images. Allow the images to emotionally continue, you know, just to flow and just to notice and just to notice. And there's this really great video online where he does this with a Marine who got traumatized in war and a bomb went off and, you know, he was discharged and stuff. And the VA and the current medical system diagnosed him with having Tourette's. But the Tourette's, it kind of looked like this. And for people who can't see the video, like it was a twitching of his right shoulder coming up and the and his head slightly twitching towards that shoulder. And what Peter Levine was able to do on video, it's incredible. You guys can find this on YouTube, is he slowly teaches him the felt sense. And then the image that starts to come up when the tick happens is the felt sense of the bomb going off. And then Peter Levine has him start to do some of these body practices.
Like he's flinching.
Exactly. Yeah. And in the course of one session live, he got to the point where the man wasn't twitching anymore. And this dude had Tourette's or was diagnosed with having Tourette's because he had that flinching, you know, like 100 times a day for years. And one of the things that he'd do is he had him do that jaw thing, you know, and he didn't weep, but it taught his body that it was actually okay to feel the twitch and not look away from the twitch. And the way it's described in that video and for a lot of people is that when you feel into one of these instinctual coping patterns and you allow it to simply move through you as opposed to instantly trying to repress it, because that's what we all kind of do, is it feels like you absorb energy into your body and you get this like flush sensation. Mm-hmm. And it almost feels like an intrinsic relaxation sensation. And the physiology there might be, it's called toning the vagus nerve, but essentially one of the key physiological components to trauma healing is retraining the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve is essentially the largest nerve in the body that starts in the brainstem and goes into every major organ and like goes all the way down to your root. And that they have found that the improving someone's felt sense connection to their vagus nerve is highly correlated with them essentially reducing the symptoms of trauma, because it teaches you that it's okay to be safe in your body now.
That's what I've been doing with those ice baths, because I know it trains those. And some days it's really, 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 really hard for me. And, you know, and some days it's not. And I think the days that it is, it's teaching me a lot more.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And a couple things came up when you were talking. So number one, I don't know how to voice this, but you're going to know exactly what I mean. I've been on a real personal journey lately where I just feel like with the things you were saying, like the guy with the tick, we tend so much to just treat our heads and consider it so separate with anything that we've got going on in our body. And I love that there's so much somaticness and that we're holding it in our bodies and there are ways to release it. Cause I think we discount that so many times.
Yeah.
And I know that like, you know, lately I feel like I hear the word meat suit a lot and like I think that creates a bit of a disconnect. And when we were in Costa Rica, Aubrey mentioned that and he was like, no, this is part of it. And I was glad he said that, cause that was exactly what had been on my mind. And that this is all part of this experience, all right. of it together. And we can't discount this connection. And so I don't even know if I'm getting at a question here, but like, I just want to encourage people to pay closer attention. Yeah. I even talked about this last week. I was talking about hearing what our bodies are telling us and are we listening? And that's just even part of it too. Like, we can think we're just treating the trauma with our fucking, you know, therapy or whatever it is you're doing, but there's more to it.
Right.
This is all part of the package.
Right. So there's a few things here that are really interesting. One is there's a metaphor that has been used in cognitive psychology in the last like 8 years since we've really started to appreciate the depth and the power of the body. And the metaphor that is being used is called the elephant and the rider. And that if you feel into what it feels like to be a human, your emotional body is like an elephant and your thinking mind is the rider. And there's different arguments about why language even evolved. But one of the arguments is that the rider evolved to essentially convince other riders about whatever the elephant is doing is okay. So on one level, we developed language as a way to fit into a community. of other elephants, but that once you really study the power of the elephant is calling the shots. And the essence of the rider, if you're unconscious,
like you're kidding yourself if you think you're in charge of the elephant.
Right. And that the unconscious function of the rider is to justify to itself that it's controlling right. the elephant, that it's in charge, and that it tells stories to other riders and elephants about why it does what it does. And there's
but your elephant may go on a rampage. Right. And they just go fucking hauling right. ass through the
there are hundreds and hundreds of experiments that essentially show the elephant's in charge. And if the elephant is traumatized, the rider can't stop it. Now, what's interesting is the rider has the ability to, in the moments that the elephant's relaxed, the rider can actually restructure the environment that primes the elephant to act in the ways that's actually healthy for the elephant. And so this comes down to like, the way the way to really do habit change is not to try to force the elephant to do what you want it to do. But when the elephant's content, can you redesign your environment to prime the elephant to eat the right way and mm-hmm. to move the right way and to do all these different
things? That's what that vagus nerve training is, exactly. you know, if you're in the ice bath or exactly. in some situation where you force the fight or flight in a moment of calm, right?
Exactly. And the other avenue here, the thing to connect to, and it's incredible if you can connect to the depth, is that we are evolved animals. And in our evolutionary history, we were able to navigate surviving in the world and being in community with other social animals for hundreds of thousands or millions of years before we ever even had language.
Just because you might not be dressing up doesn't mean you shouldn't dress well. Good Life is American-made from the finest materials. And Good Life's core collection of premium essentials keeps you looking good and feeling great. Good Life just opened a new store in the Domain Northside here in Austin. So stop by this new Austin location and get 20% off in-store when you mention code AMY20, AMY20. Code is also valid on your entire order at goodlifeclothing.com. Elevate your game with Good Life.
The intelligence of our bodies, when it's in the environment it evolved to be in, and a part of that environment is like a deep community of like 120 to 150 people. We are geniuses at how to navigate that type of environment, even without using language. Language only came in the last maybe 100,000 years. And it's the youngest and the quote unquote weakest in relation to the deeper structures of the brain.
Have you tried navigating that without language?
Very, very recently and really? Just beginning. Oh,
what'd you do?
Right. So this is an incredible practice for people. But like if you meet someone and depending on how weird you want to be, this can be a first
I want to be weird. Yeah. I want to know the weirdest.
Eye gates.
Oh, yeah. I've done that.
And don't speak.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even this really great idea where you purposefully go on a date with your partner where the rule of the date is you don't get to talk. And that both of you have to just communicate non-verbally. And what's fucking incredible is the moment you get past the weirdness that might last for maybe like 5 minutes, you are going to drop into a knowledge that your body already has, that you're going to be able to interact with this human in this brand new way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I did in Sedona, I think I did a workshop or something and I did the eye gazing with someone I didn't know at all, Kyle Dow. And you know, you do break past that barrier. We're like, okay, I guess I'm finally comfortable here because it's been awkward for the last 5 minutes. And, and I know there are people who do this with their kids too, which seems like an amazing thing to foster with your children.
Absolutely.
If you can get them to.
Right.
Yeah.
And like, one of the things to feel into is the moment someone you know walks into the room, if you can actually track what is happening in your body, you know if they're upset. No language was exposed at all. Also, what's really interesting, and this is an experiment that anyone here can do.
I love experiments.
Is go out somewhere public. And if you're walking and you see someone kind of like across the street or something, look and look back. And even if they're facing away from you, and I do this all the time, if you look at someone and there's almost no way that they could actually see you with their eyes, more often than not, they will itch the part of their head that you looked at. And I do this all the time.
What?
Right. Our animal bodies are so incredibly intelligent that one of the things that we've evolved to be able to discern at a genius level is when another human has eyes on us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know? Yeah. You can feel it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure women are so much more connected to this than men because of the traumas and dysfunctions of our culture and how men operate. But that, you know, when you're being watched, even if you don't understand how you know you're being watched. Mm-hmm. And that there might not be any like materialistic, rational way that you could even explain how that's happening. But those are just different examples of how powerful we are already communicating in a way that's nonverbal at all. And then there's like paint, draw, dance, sing, but don't sing words, hum.
You know, I was thinking about that when you were talking about feeling and people, you know, being out of touch with how they felt. But so much about music is just like, we can't explain.
Right.
You just feel.
Right.
You know,
and
classical in particular, you know, if you're listening right. to something lyric free or whatever.
There is no human who doesn't know how to dance. Any human that says they don't know how to dance, what they're saying is, I don't know how to move when I'm judging myself or when I think other people are judging me. Mm-hmm. But every child.
Right.
If you play music, they just start to move, mm-hmm. you know, and that's another example of the nonverbal intelligence that's always here.
Mm-hmm. So another thing that came up that I wanted to mention, I don't know, are you familiar with Byron Katie and her work?
Vaguely. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things she does is you just ask four questions about anything. And I got into this maybe about a little over a year ago, and it's just been useful of taking kind of what you're saying, but putting it on just an everyday scale. And they basically take a statement like, he hates me, whatever it is, whatever little judgment you're making. Let's just use that for example, like, oh, that guy hates me. And then you go, is that true? I don't know. That's probably not. And then you go, how can I really know that to be true? And no, obviously I cannot. But sometimes the answer is yes, you know, it doesn't matter. The third question is, how do I feel when I think this thought? And what I've noticed just from doing this procedure or process is that it has made me really way cognizant of how I feel when I think a thought. And when you get like pissed off at somebody or whatever it is, your blood pressure rises. And if you can just sit for a second and feel how that feels and what it's bringing up in your body, it's so useful because it's just a smaller version of exactly what you're saying about these traumas. Cause that can turn into habits, turn into probably things that are debilitating in the long run. And I just love that procedure of just taking a moment, you know, aside from her teachings, but just saying like, on a small scale. And do you do that all the time? Do you feel like when you have a thought or a judgment, you can really tap into it? And that's like some, maybe a practice that you've cultivated?
For sure. Not all the time, but I'm curious before I go into what came up, what's the fourth question?
Oh, you're right. What is the fourth question? How would I feel if I could never think this thought again?
Interesting. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then you go, and the answer almost every time is free.
Right.
And right. you just go, huh? Maybe that's constricting me, not only physically, mentally, the whole thing.
Right.
And then you feel this openness and freeness.
Right. So what's interesting is they've done studies and they have found that I believe the average person will have something like at least 8,000 thoughts a day.
Yeah. Something crazy, right?
And most of them are unconscious and negative and repeating. And one of the things that has been...
I'm sitting here like repeating the thought, man.
Right.
Yeah, I'm totally fucking guilty of that.
One of the things that has been truly liberating for me is that once you connect to like, what are the common emotions that arise in you when you feel, or that when you're responding to a negative thought? And it might be shame, it might be guilt, it might be fear, it might be unworthiness, whatever.
It's a whole host of like
right.
shit stuff.
Right. If you feel into it, all of us have created a whole set of coping behaviors that we do as soon as we feel any of those feelings. And the coping behavior are your addictions, and everyone has addictions. You know, like one of mine is working, you know, like if I have something to do, I don't have to deal with the fact that I feel guilty for how good my life is. If I have a day where I don't get to work, I have to sit with that. But we all have addictions, and our addictions are our coping patterns to not feel the negative emotion that's arising. And so one of the things that I've started to use in the last couple of years is the model of internal family systems. And essentially, internal family systems is a model of the psyche that essentially says, you are not a single person. You're a collection of different people. And most of the people inside of you are guards that your inner wounded child has created so you don't feel whatever the emotions are that you don't want to feel. And the emotions are then exiled. And the guards are kind of like this group of people inside of you that each represent different behavioral patterns that are trying to keep you from feeling the grief and the pain and the hopelessness and the apathy and the fear and the anger.
So when somebody has multiple personalities and they're protecting, are those just those guards just coming out bigger?
So there's debate here, but...
Sorry, not to get you off track. I was just curious.
This is really interesting is that depending on how extreme a believer is in this model, some people are as extreme as saying is a multiple personality disorder is the word that we've used for people who have such strong guards that they don't, that they completely step in, but that multiple personality disorder is the highest volume of a psychic function that's happening in all of us.
Yeah. Like, yeah. That's what, yeah.
Exactly. And that I've, for the last couple of years, have developed this whole inner castle, basically, where I've tried to identify each of my major guards. I've given them names, and I've really tried to get to know them.
What are their names?
So the one...
This I just want to know what you name them.
Right. I am fucking dramatic, so most of my names are dramatic.
I'm sure you pulled from history and
exactly,
myth.
Exactly, and mythology, and, yes. So the first part that I became aware of, I call him Fenrir. And Fenrir is a Nordic wolf god that essentially killed Odin because he was the most powerful monster god. And Odin was the king god. And there's this thing called Ragnarok where all the gods fought each other. Mm-hmm. But he was essentially like the most powerful monstrous thing. And he was this wolf and he ate things. And one of my coping patterns for a long time was to be hyper intellectual. So I could disconnect from my heart, and I used philosophy as a weapon, you know, to like always be able to win in any type of situation.
Sure. I majored in philosophy. I know what you're talking about.
Right. And it wasn't until hindsight that I realized that the reason I was so intensely activated in that way was because I didn't want to feel any of my feelings. And so it was hyper intellectual. Another very active part, I call him Samson, you know, from the Bible. Mm-hmm. And he's the part that believes that women will betray me. And so he's my like angry protector that comes out in relationships whenever I'm able to tell a story that I'm not safe in the relationship or that I'm not being treated well. And
is it him talking then that's telling those stories?
Right. So at least everyone's internal experience is going to be unique. I don't hear voices, but there's...
I didn't really mean that.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are specific stories that I can feel, oh, that's Samson talking.
Got it.
You know? And I've done a bunch of work where like, if I feel him starting to get activated, I will either imagine I'm talking to him or I'll go get a journal and I'll literally write out his name and then I'll try to channel what it feels like he's saying.
That seems really useful.
It's so useful.
Yeah.
And then what I imagine, so what internal family systems calls is that there's a part of you that they call the capital S self. And that part of you is whole, healed, has never been wounded, can't be wounded. And if you can connect to the self energy, it instantly starts to bring order and peace to whatever parts are activated.
I mean, that's the God part, right? That would be the...
Buddhists would call it the witness or just it's pure awareness. It's the thing that is, there is a part of you that has witnessed your life since the moment you were conscious. That part of you has never been hurt. It's never been sad. It's never been happy. It witnesses your entire unfolding. And I imagine that as the king of my internal family systems. And so I will try to speak as the king to Samson. And Samson might say, you know, because the way Samson used to operate in my life before I became conscious of it was essentially, if I don't feel safe, I'm just going to cut you out of my life. Mm-hmm. I'm just done. I'll just freeze you out. And I know a lot of women know men who cope like that, mm-hmm. you know, and of course there are women that cope like that too. And so Samson's anger might be, don't talk to her anymore, cut it off, be done. And then the king will try to talk to him and be like, okay, what's a compromise? How can I hear you and not just repress you? But what is something that I can do that is actually loving and for the good of all of us? And so maybe it's you have a hard conversation with the other person about this behavior made me feel triggered because of a wound that I have. And there's a part of me that wants to not talk to you anymore. Mm-hmm. What my request is, and this is getting into nonviolent communication, which is incredible. And this is something that we can go into if you want. But my request is that the next time that you make plans with me, you either keep them or you don't make the plan, you know, like keep your word, you know? And that what begins to heal these guardians or these guards is by changing your behavior that doesn't fit the coping pattern, and then you feeling that you actually feel safe on the other side. And so a great book that kind of, it doesn't really teach it in this way, but it really helps, is The Holistic Psychologist's mm-hmm. most recent book called How to Do the Work.
I just was looking at something about that. Just like 2 days ago, of course, because
it's incredible.
Well, so what happens to Samson? Is he just sitting and chilling? What's he doing?
So what's incredible is one of the pitfalls of the spiritual community that I see happening over and over and over again is people think that if they've healed something once, that it's gone forever. And that's going to come back to bite you in the ass, because I don't believe that that's how the psyche operates.
I think everything's a practice. Like,
the deep wisdom here is that each of these parts, if you could connect to them and actually integrate them, they have a gift for you. And so the gift of Samson is that he is the part of me that gives me the power to articulate healthy boundaries. And so Samson actually gets to be an ally for when I need to have hard conversations. It's actually Samson who's present with me when I have the hard conversation. Mm-hmm. And if Samson, if I'm conscious of this part and I integrate it, it has a gift for me. And so, like, you know, like the coping pattern of Fenrir is my gift to do research, and is my gift to parse through people's own ego stories to help them get to a point where they can realize, oh, that's not true. But when Fenrir was unconscious, I wouldn't let you have an experience because I would explain how it's not real. You know, and that was aggressive and unconscious. Mm-hmm. But the gift of Fenrir is like, I can pierce through people's stories, you know? And so each of these parts, one of the things to relax into is that every trauma that you have had has in it a gift. And that if that gift can be integrated, you become more of who I believe you are meant to be. Like, I believe that you're born with a soul, mm-hmm. and that your soul knows what you are meant to be in this life, and that everything that has happened to you is to give you the potential gifts that if you seize them, you'd become who you're meant to be. And there's a great story that I think is worth sharing. And it's that Plato is regarded as probably the top philosopher of all time. And there's a bunch of people that might argue with that, but he for sure is one of the most influential philosophers.
Sure. Yes.
He wrote a book called The Republica, mm-hmm. which was his attempt. It was his magnum opus. It was his greatest work. And it was him trying to articulate what a ideal society would look like. And it's this really technical, philosophical work. And
then I've read it, but it's been a million years. So
the very last chapter is a myth. He puts a myth in at the end, and it's called the myth of Ur, E-R. And essentially, the myth is that there is this warrior who was a good enough human where the gods granted him the ability to actually go see what happens after death because he dies in a war. And then he's going to get to come back in 9 days and tell people what happens when you die. And so when he dies, he goes to what's called the middle world, and there's four judges. And the middle world judges souls about whether or not they need to acquire more wisdom. And the lower world is where Earth is. And the higher world is whatever word you would use to say heaven. And whenever a soul completes a lifetime in either of those worlds, they have to come to the middle world and be judged. And the judgment is not about whether you're good or bad. The judgment is about, do you have to go acquire more wisdom? Because when you spend a life or a soul cycle in the higher realm, there's nothing hard. So you actually decrease in wisdom. And when you go down to the lower world, because it's hard, you increase in wisdom. And so the souls that are judged as having to learn for another cycle, then have to go on this pilgrimage to, the way it's described is really beautiful, but that there's a woman on a throne embedded in a rainbow column that connects all three worlds. And man, I'm blanking on what her name is, but she's the queen of the muses. And the muses were essentially the things that dictated your fate. So all the souls have to go back to the lower world. They have to go to a pilgrimage to this muse or to the queen of the muses. And when they get to her throne, there's a bunch of golden threads laid out in front of the throne. And the souls pick the thread. And the thread is the life that they're going to go live on Earth to learn whatever they have to learn. And the first soul that gets to pick was a soul that spent its past soul cycle in the higher realm. Because it had lost wisdom, it just grabbed the first thread that it thought had the most power and beauty in it. And the one catch is, once you touch your thread, you have to live it out. And so a part of his thread was he was going to become a dictator, but he would eventually have to eat his children. And, you know, this is Greek mythology, yeah. So they're going for it. But at the height of it, he would know all the pleasure, all the power, all the quote unquote freedom. The last soul to pick was Odysseus. And Odysseus is the hero from Homer's Odyssey. And he went through so many trials. Because he had enough wisdom, he slowly looked through each of the threads and he picked the one that was the life of a farmer that would have a healthy and beautiful family and would live in a time of peace. And so he chose that thread. Now, here's the interesting part. Once you choose your thread, each of the souls go in a cave underneath the throne of this goddess to the river of forgetting. And you have to drink at the river of forgetting so your soul is light enough to pass into the lower world. But after you've drank, the queen of the muses gives you what's called a daemon. And the daemon is your guardian that remembers your thread. And it lives with you in the world. And this is actually where Western culture gets the idea of daemon. And Plato tells stories of Socrates, who's his mentor. And Socrates was given the title as the wisest person in Athens because he only listened to his daemon. And his daemon would tell him what not to do. And I believe that we all have that force inside of us and that it's the thing that whispers to you. Every time I've ever brought this up to any human ever, they know what I'm talking about. And that there's something in you that doesn't feel like you, but feels like it's for you, that is constantly giving you little whispers as like, go do that thing. Don't do that thing. This wasn't the right thing. This was the right thing. And that I believe that that thing is trying to bring you to your golden thread, and that all of the traumas that have happened to you are actually designed for you, by you, to bring you back to that thread. And that in order to get the gifts of the traumas, you're going to be invited to sit with them. You know, there's this quote by Rumi, or it's a poem, and I wish I could remember it verbatim, but it's called The Guest House. And it's essentially, you know, you're going to have guests knocking on your door. Let them in, whether it's anger or grief. And once they've done whatever they want to do to the house, and maybe that's they destroy all the pictures and they upturn the furniture, invite them to have tea with you and have tea with them. And then when they've shared whatever their message is, they'll go. Mm-hmm. You know, and the invitation is to bring it back full circle. I don't think you heal these parts. I think that you learn how to be a conductor, and that each of these parts are specific, unique aspects of the symphony only you can play. And so Fenrir and Samson are like a tuba and a drum. Mm-hmm. And when they're unconscious, they're out of rhythm. But there's a part of me, the king or the self, that is like a little bit slower, a little bit louder. And that the fullest expression of what you are is when you bring all those instruments together and then you play your song. It's not about healing the instrument so it goes away. It's about integrating the instrument so it can add to the song.
Yeah. And I have like some deep insecurities. And so I had some things come up over the last 2 weeks and really triggered those. And, you know, I've done enough work to where I was like, how can I really view this as a gift? How can I see the gift in this? And I think that's part of the practice is you get quicker to, yes, it was really fucking hard and I cried a lot, but at the same time, I knew deep down that this had something to offer me.
Right.
And that comes with that training, that comes with that daemon, that comes with that, you know what, stepping back into that awareness. You know every time that this is going to teach you. And sometimes it just takes age and experience and just,
right,
you know, just to know, yeah, I'm not only going to survive this, but you know that you always learn something.
Right. And there's two things that come up when you say that I think is really important to highlight. You let yourself cry. One of the things
I did, I cried my fucking face off for like a week straight,
which is the thing that most spiritual people, when they first start to find these words, don't do, and they spiritually bypass.
Really?
And it's positive vibes only. I see this
that
all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, that.
And so the key
I'm
part here.
I'm a wholeness type. Right. Let's embrace the dark.
Exactly. The key here is allow yourself to feel the truth of the feelings that arise. And then as you let the feelings work on you, then feel into what the gifts are. But there's a lot of people I know who, once they start to find some of these tools, they want to skip the feeling and go straight to, oh, this is perfect. This is for me, et cetera. And those people have a look in their eyes when they're telling you how perfect their life is, where you can feel like they're like one joke away from fucking snapping. Right. And so like, that is absolutely,
I know people.
You know exactly. And I like, it's something that happens a lot here. And the other thread to feel into that I can feel myself forgetting, but I feel the moment you start talking again, it'll come up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Oh, that's okay. You know, one thing I was going to say too with that, and about allowing those feelings out, sometimes, you know, you'll stay strong for other people or for appearances. And I found myself denying it around my children. Mm-hmm. And I learned a really big lesson because they knew. And they were both like my little one. She's almost 12, not that little, but she would sidle up to me and be like, "Mom, you seem sad. Are you sad?" And I was like, "I'm fine, honey. I'm fine." I was that, which was a fucking lie. And then my older one started to say it. She was like, "What's wrong with you? You seem distracted. What's going on?" And I was like, I'm good. I'm good. And I talked to another friend, actually a guest who was on a couple weeks ago, Addie Broyles. And I ended up talking to her about it. And I told her, my girls are sensing it. And she said, you need to model that honesty with them. And it wasn't even so much about modeling honesty, but it was about allowing those feelings in an appropriate way. And I had to feel into that moment and say, I went back to them both and I got them both together. And I said, you guys are right. I don't want you to doubt your intuition. You guys are totally right. I am sad. Here's a very, very light version toward them of right. what's going on.
That's huge.
And I have been feeling sad and it's all going to be okay and work out. I just, you know, and it actually was a gift to me in that moment because my little one was totally satisfied then. She just like was like, okay, and pranced off. And I was like, okay. And my other one was like, well, what exactly?
Yes.
You know, but it was such a major lesson of leaning into the truth of those feelings and allowing them
that
what we
so
just
huge.
Want to cover it up.
I love that. And I could not celebrate that more.
It was scary.
Right.
And I didn't really know how to navigate it until I experienced it. And somebody said, you have an opportunity here. And I was like, you're right.
And what's beautiful is this actually brings the whole thing full circle. It's the intelligence of the nonverbal. Your children know you at a level that is impossible to actually comprehend. And they have intuition. And that's their
I feel this in my heart right now, Eric.
And like, that's their whisper.
Yeah.
And that as a parent, and I'm not a parent yet, but I truly aspire to be, and I can't wait, this is heavy to feel into, but when you lie to someone, you actually pollute the signal of their daemon.
Whoa.
Like that's
you pollute the signal of their daemon. Holy shit.
And then you create an environment where whatever feedback you get is also polluted because you didn't put out an authentic signal.
Right.
And then what you get back
to sowing that mistrust of themselves. Right. Of their, yeah.
And what's wild is some of the rebel psychiatrists who gave alternative healing methods to schizophrenics. There was one in America and there was one in Britain. And essentially what they found is that if you put a schizophrenic or someone diagnosed as schizophrenic into an environment where you've trained all the people in the environment to fundamentally never lie and treat the schizophrenic like they're an equal, that not even trying to do any healing, that in the course of 4 to 6 months, their symptoms of schizophrenia go down dramatically.
Holy shit, it clears their signal?
Right. So, and then here's what's super interesting. The British psychiatrist found that if they go back to the environment that they first were in that brought them there, they will have the full-blown symptoms again in just a couple of months. And the hypothesis is, if you grow up in a family system or an environment where everyone's lying, your daemon is polluted and doesn't know how to function. Like it's not getting authentic.
What if you're doing the lying too?
Right. Right.
Like and if we're lying too, that's
exactly.
Okay.
If you're in an environment where everyone's strategy is lying, you will very quickly pick up that own strategy.
Sure.
That's a interesting side note, but the thing that I forgot that now I remembered, is people will have moments once you start to do quote unquote the work. And I wish there was a word for it, but there's a moment that you will have where you will have the felt sense that everything that has ever happened to you is perfect because it brought you to this moment that you are currently in of absolute wholeness.
All right. I have that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that once you have that once.
You need to coin that term.
I'll figure it out.
Yes.
That once you have that moment the first time. People will, once they get out of it for a couple of weeks or months, they'll explain it away. But once you have it another time and then a third time, this part of you begins to develop faith where it's like, I know I'm going to have another moment like that. And that everything that I'm going through, even though I can't see it right now, is absolutely for me because I've had those moments before where it's not a story you tell. It's a feeling you feel of absolute perfect wholeness that instantly like heals your entire past, or at least brings down the volume of the trauma fundamentally in a way where you're like, all of that is what brought me here right now. And that once you can get to the point, and I dare say that I feel that most of the time, where when I'm going through the mud and I'm weeping, and sometimes I'm weeping so hard that I feel my throat is tearing, you know, and it sounds like an animal is dying.
Yeah.
I can feel my soul behind me, like clapping and laughing because it has felt those moments enough to know, I don't know when, I don't know how, but I'm going to have another of those moments that is going to perfectly show me that this is exactly what I needed.
Mm-hmm. It was for me, like it was like those soul cries, but at the same time, and it's not to say you feel that all the time, but then, you know, it's that practice that gets easier. And then you just can slip back into knowing the knowing of, it's all happening for me. And it's all a gift.
so feel fully.
Goddamn.
So feel fully.
So feel what? Say that again.
So feel it fully.
So feel it fully.
Because again, the thing that I see is that people will bypass the descent into the underworld.
Yeah.
By hyperfixating on, oh, it's perfect. So if it's perfect, trust and feel what you actually feel right now. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's grief. Maybe that's anger at God. Whatever.
For me last week, it led to a whole roller coaster of emotions that I just let out. And that was really hard. And I couldn't identify it at first. I sat there and I was like, finally, I was like, holy shit, I'm feeling resentment. Like, I am fucking so resentful right now. And I mean, luckily I was able to express it to my partner in a way where he heard it and was accepting of it. That's so huge. It is huge because that's a tough one, especially when you're expressing it to the person you're resentful toward at that moment, you know? And so, but I really was like, this is a gift to teach me some things about myself and to look into further my own insecurities and my own things. But, right. But I still was feeling it fully.
Absolutely.
And letting myself.
And the thing to offer there for people is resentment is almost always the result of self-transgression because you weren't enforcing a boundary that felt authentic.
I wasn't speaking up enough, I guess. Right. Yeah. And
so the invitation when you feel resentment is, okay, where have I self-transgressed my boundaries?
Yeah. And I had like consistently over months and finally, and I was able to say, we got to look back at this. And I was not honoring myself, which was actually a gift because then it made me go, now I know more about how to honor myself.
And it likely led to a change in the relationship that makes it better.
Massive.
Yes.
Massive, which, you know, is still in progress, but at the same time, it led to my own change in just really tapping into that security of you're grounded in this moment. Everything's okay. Don't look at this anxiety, the stories you're making up about the future or stories that you're clinging to from the past.
And what's wild, like a thing to relax into is whenever you withhold any type of truth from your partner, you create distance in the intimacy, like in the psychological intimacy.
Yeah.
The moment you share whatever it is, even if it's hard, it actually creates intimacy.
I'm glad you brought up that word because I've been like it made me not even understand what intimacy was anymore. I like became sort of this person full of like, does it even exist? Like I started questioning like, what is marriage? Does it exist? Does a bond between two people even exist? Like I had some major philosophical questions come up around it that I still haven't really found the answers to. So I'm glad you said that because it does. Even with my children, there was like an intimacy once I cleared the air, cleared that thread or cleared, you know, the lie that I essentially told, you know?
You allow people to see into you. And the thing about intimacy that's interesting is that if you're someone who struggles with that feeling of, is it even possible? My intuition is that it's because it's not being cultivated in the most important relationship, which is the one with yourself. Mm-hmm. If you lie to yourself, you create a disruption that then affects every relationship outside of you.
Well, so intimacy with yourself, what is that then?
Right.
Would that be like,
it's being honest with yourself. So for me, it came with journaling that the moment I began journaling spiritually, like with a spiritual intention to be honest with myself, and I do it every day, I maintain a authentic and intimate relationship with myself where I allow myself to admit things that I would never articulate to anyone because it's not loving, but it's things that I think. And that because I feel intimate with myself, I truly believe that you can have intimacy with anyone.
Mm-hmm. You do.
Right.
Okay.
100%. And one of the things to feel into is it is a function of our culture's disassociation from nature that we even believe that we can be individuals. The fact that you can even hold the idea, I'll just do it on my own, is because you are living on a culture that has done so many things for you that you can't see, that is required if culture wasn't there to be filled by humans. Like the every time you eat, hundreds or thousands of people were responsible for making that process unfold in such a way where you can eat.
Oh, get in your car and drive down the street.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that a human being without connection is not a human. Mm. Like we don't even like a human is a connected creature. And that there is no creature that is not a connected creature. And it's a function of our idolization of the mind that you could even, or that any human can even hold the belief that intimacy is not possible. And that like, in order for you to even be talking to me right now, there's a whole army of humans who've had to do things in order for us to even be able to do this. Like we are social creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it just, my faith in it took a knock somehow, you know, and I just had to like, I've had to do the work to come back to myself and find that, you know, and like retrust and, and open back up within myself and then in that relationship. And so,
and like you know, the thing that Gabor Mate talks about, that's really heavy to feel into, but is also true, is if we connect to all of our parents and our parents' parents, they grew up in a system that destroyed them with stress. And our parents, most of us did not have even one parent that knew how to be intimate with us, that truly knew how, because like one of the things that I feel into is my parents raised me without the internet. My parents raised me without a single elder in their immediate environment. How did they do it? How did they succeed in me not dying? And that if you like, most of our intimacy wounds starts with how our parents were able to show up. And our parents' parents were even more disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like my dad's dad beat his mom so often that my dad had to fight his dad. My mom's mom would almost break her nose with how hard she would slap her. But my mom's mom was raised in an orphanage by nuns who the trauma they have been through, I can't even imagine. And my dad's dad, I don't even know what his environment was, but each of us who are alive now have the opportunity to do a type of intimacy healing with ourselves that we can pass on to our children. And then our children are going to start from a base that we didn't get. And they're going to be able to pass it on to their children in a way. And,
yeah,
you're doing good work.
I'm trying so hard to live that, you know, and just to recognize that and look at the things that my parents couldn't. And I mean, like, I don't blame them or anything like that. Right. It's just, that's the way it was. They had the stress they had. My parents were older when they had me. So they were like they were growing up in like the 50s, you know? So, I mean, a whole nother thing.
Right. And like the moment that you shared that you had with your children, where you were like, you know what? You two were right.
Yeah.
Something. It's no knock on my parents, but I never had a moment like that with either of my parents.
I didn't either.
Even once. Mm-mm. And so if you feel into the massiveness of healing that single moment, and the fact that you've had even that moment will tells me that you've had multiple moments like that. You're healing something deep inside of your children that they're going to be able to pass on to their children.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. Because really, we're just trying to spread it and make it a better world when it comes down to it, you know?
Yeah.
And be the best version of ourselves. And you mentioned journaling, and I just want to mention your Dharma journal, because I'm excited to go through that, and I haven't had a chance yet. And I know it's about 5 or 6 days you spend on it, correct?
Six
days. And you can build this temple, this inner temple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, and even you mentioning the guards and the internal family system, like I'm curious in exploring this for myself, and, and I'm encouraging others to do it too. And sometimes I think, you know, all the things that I preach on my show are about efficiency and doing our best with the time we've got to uplevel our lives in the most efficient way and just become our most shiny selves. But it's,
I love that.
Thank you. Well, you know, I just want to encourage people to, it doesn't take a ton of time, but it's worth it to do some of these bigger project type things.
Right. Yeah. The thing that I would offer is that if people are interested in doing the Guardian work, I have a journaling course that's not the Dharma Journal that helps people create a journaling habit, but then also start to work with the guards. The Dharma Journal, I've had a hard time explaining really what it is, but essentially what it is I've studied the language of the unconscious for a decade now. And the main way through that is dream interpretation. And that I've created 7 guided meditations. The last one is a daily one that you can do every day. That's 11 minutes. But I help people use the language of the unconscious to create a character inside of them that is essentially their daemon. Mm-hmm. And that the daemon will give you some visions. And then through integrating the vision of your ideal life, you begin to build a temple inside of you that I've constructed in a way where once you go inside it, you will essentially have a revelatory experience of your higher self. And they will essentially give you a map on how to live day by day. And the last meditation, that is the daily meditation, is 11 minutes long. And it allows you to, in 11 minutes, feel first that you are playing this long, infinite game of becoming who you could be. And then connecting to your higher self in such a way where it lets you know what is the one sacred thing for you to do today to create your ideal future. And then go do that thing, dude.
And you don't even have to put it into words.
Right.
Maybe you can just feel it.
100%.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do the Dharma Journal. And then I was wondering, would you come back and we can talk again?
I would love to.
Good. I've never asked anyone to do that ever.
I'm honored.
Yeah. You're the first. So thank you very much. Is there anything that you'd like to share before we wrap up or anything that you feel called even to reiterate or just something that I don't know that you're feeling perhaps?
There's a quote that I can't remember verbatim, but it gets to the essence of this. And it's that I truly believe that everything that has ever happened to you has happened for you by something inside of you, your daemon, that has created it for you to transform you from who you are into a little bit more who you could be. And that you have a sacred expression that only you can give the world. And that your life is essentially trying to bring you to become that thing, and to become that thing who you are on a psychological level will have to die multiple deaths. And that that's you doing it right.
You're doing it right then. And there is no right except you're right. Mm-hmm. Yes. You just like encapsulated what I believe. Eric, I love it. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
You know what? I've got these cards. I'm going to be talking about them in my intro. You want to draw one before we go? Let's see.
So pause. Yes. Actually, my intuition is the one that fell out is the one for me.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Energetic clearing is what you got.
During crises, the Holy One herself may be emptying you of fear and attachments, preparing you to receive her luminous plan.
Exactly. Perfect. Okay. I'm going to cover your links really quick before we go to for Eric Godsey. Eric goddamn Godsey. Yeah. Do people call you that?
No, but this
is
awesome.
Oh my God. It's like your catchphrase. It should be.
Goddamn.
Everybody can find you. It's E-R-I-C-K.
Yes.
G-O-D-S-E-Y.
Right.
On Instagram.
And also that's my website.
And also that's your website. And then Dharma Journal is at thedharmajournal.com.
Yes.
And it is on Notion.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
I love you.
I love you too. Like a lot. And I'm really, really grateful that you said yes to this and stepped in, because I knew that you have so much wisdom and knowledge, and I just have never been able to have a really long conversation with you. And I'm thrilled that we got to have it and have it recorded to share with the world.
Likewise, and let's run it back.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Big thanks again to Eric for being here today. Remember that you can find him online at Eric Godsey, E-R-I-C-K-G-O-D-S-E-Y. Eric goddamn Godsey. I added the goddamn. And thedharmajournal.com too. Do that with me. It's thedharmajournal.com. Okay. So one thing that I was talking about in the intro that I want to share with you is like a little word experiment, because I like to do an affirmation here at the end. And I've done something a little different this weekend, and I just want to play with it a little bit. And one of the things I did was, when I started this podcast and started talking with Hot Pie, I started telling some other people around it, and they'd say, oh, because this was like mid last year, and they would say, oh, Joe Rogan's moving to town. Oh, you should talk to him or meet him or whatever, you know? And like, you know, you're a podcaster and you're just like, yeah. I started saying like, yeah, I'm sure I'm just going to bump right into Joe Rogan and meet him right off the bat. Well, y'all, I never said, I'm not going to meet Joe Rogan. Instead, I said it sarcastically, like, yeah, I'm sure I'm just going to bump right into him. Well, I did. I met him twice now, and he's cool. And I guess I just started toying with the idea of, could the universe and our own inner creator possibly not know the difference between sarcasm and an actual affirmation we're trying to believe? Like, what if you really just started saying like, yeah, I'm sure $1 million is going to fall in my lap. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, what if the sarcasm, instead of putting ourselves down, like, what if you just maybe experimented with a little bit of sarcasm? So I'm playing with that. And I wore this shirt the other day because I was like, how else can I play with that? And as I was thinking about it, I was wearing that shirt from the Obsidian Blade that he sent me that says, meditated my way to the top. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm sure I'm just going to meditate my way to the top. And then I was like, oh, there's one. And so maybe when you just have one come up, maybe just cling to it a little bit and just play with it and let's see what happens. I'm sure I'm just going to meditate my way right to the top. Just fucking Oprah levels. Why not? So how can you play with that? That's what I wanted to end with today. And I also just want to end with Eric. Man, thank you so much. And I just hope you enjoyed that as much as I did, because it was phenomenal. And I'm just blown away by these guests and the people. People have so much wisdom and so much to offer. Everyone does. And you do. And you're showing up for yourself and just fostering that fucking light inside you every time. Every time that we listen, every time that we have these conversations, every time that you just go a little bit further. And that's the fucking badass thing. So thank you so much for being here. If you can hit those 5 stars, man, that's like a thing. So if you can, please, please, please do. And share with a friend too, if you feel called. If you just had somebody hop in your mind during this, then go for it. Send it to them. And also, if you want to sign up for my newsletter, please do. It's at amyedwards.com, and I'll be sharing, you know, various odds and ends as we progress in there and taking the stories that we talk about just a little bit further. So I get a little candid in there for sure. So thanks again to Eric. Thanks again to you for being here. Thank you again, guys, for being here. Everybody that supports here at Hot Pie, I'm just so grateful. I can't even tell you. And any other business I forgot? I think that's probably it. So peace and love and light and health and wealth and joy and outrageous openness and all the good stuff to you and yours. Till next time. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked this show, please rate and review. It totally matters. And I encourage you to spread the love too and share this episode with a friend if you feel called. Find me and my newsletter sign up at amyedwards.com. And you can also connect with me on Instagram at @RealAmyEdwards or in Clubhouse at @AmyEdwards, or write to me. It's amy@amyedwards.com.